Bredocast. Wir erforschen was mit Medien.
Hello and welcome to the Bredocast, the podcast of the Leibniz Institute for Media Research in Hamburg. My name is Johanna Seebauer and this is episode number 44. And it is also our very first episode in English. And the reason for this is my wonderful guest today, Jonathan Hutchinson from the University of Sydney. Welcome to the show. Thanks for coming.
Thank you. Episode 44.
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
That's nice, isn't it?
And the first one in English.
Yeah, and you're the one that is introducing it.
Fantastic.
It's cool, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. So you are currently a guest researcher in our institute.
Correct. Yeah. So I'm working on the algorithm public sphere project as part of the institute.
Let me say a couple of things first about this project. It's called the APS or Algorithm Public Sphere Project. And it's basically a research network that with the general aim of finding out how algorithms nowadays influence our society, basically, how we inform ourselves, how our public discourse and so on and so forth. And your research, how does it fit into this project at the moment?
Yeah, so I've got a keen interest in automation at the moment. So my two key areas that I always research is around social media and public service media. And when those two come together, then that's a sweet spot for my research. And so at the moment, I'm looking at automation. So things like recommender systems and how they align with media production. So social influencers, for example, and how that might be situated within a public service media environment. So how would ZDF, for example, in the German context, use recommender systems, or how might they work with social media influencers, for example?
Can you explain a little bit what you mean when you say recommended systems?
Yeah, sure. Okay, so probably the easiest way to explain this is to say something like when you use Netflix and it says, you should watch this, or you're listening to Spotify and it says, people who listen to this also listen to these. So that's a like a mathematical type.
Or on Amazon, when you buy something and then they immediately say, customers that bought this also should buy this.
Exactly. That's exactly it. Yeah. So, and behind this, so that's what we see as a user of these platforms. But behind the scenes, it's a kind of a mathematical calculation that's going on. So, you know, a user's past history is then examined, processed, and a potential match with current content, or in the Amazon case, you know, things, items for sale, is then represented back to the user.
Yeah. And why is it important that we research things like that?
Well, I mean, in one instance, or from one perspective, having recommended systems is really useful. So we have a quite a saturated media environment at the moment, and so everyone's creating content, so it's hard to sort of try and find, you know, information which is useful for us as consumers. And so that's where algorithms become really important. But the flip side of that is, you know, is the recommendation correct? What is it not recommending? What's wrong about the recommendation? You know, and it could be things like it could be recommending racist material, or it could be recommending you know, age inappropriate material, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah.
So it could also lead to these so-called filter bubbles that people always go in loops, in these recommendation loops.
Yeah.
When they're on, for instance, YouTube, and videos of the same content or similar videos are recommended to them, and they cannot step outside of the bubble.
Yeah, that's exactly, that's a really great example, actually, is that you kind of get lost in the recommendation. So exposure to diversity is a way to kind of think about that. And YouTube is one of the best ones to sort of look at for that, I think, because I think you do get recommended. The algorithm works so well that the recommendations are so great that you're you could say that you're always quite happy with the media content that you're consuming. So why would you go outside of that filter bubble if it's really great? You know, if it's everything that you want to consume. You know,
and the interest of the platform is, of course, that the user stays on this platform as long as possible, right?
Correct. So, yeah. So, I mean, if you're a commercial platform, that's your primary objective, isn't it? Is to keep a user on that platform for as long as possible. And if there's advertising associated with it, then that's your commercial kind of interest.
And you are, in your current research, you're looking at the recommendation system of YouTube, right?
Yeah. So it's kind of an overarching project, which starts in... Well, I have a history in public media, as we've sort of established, but I started this particular area in commercial media to try and, you know, they do a really great job there. Both the platforms, the sort of agencies that work around that, and the influencers themselves who create this sort of material, they do it so well. It's really quite a successful model. So the kind of question I asked myself was, well, if they can do it so well there, why can't public media do such as good a job, or if not even better, of a you know, iteration of it? So that's kind of where it started, was to understand how these commercial operators go about their daily business, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Mm. And do you have an answer to that question?
I have a few, but okay. I probably have more questions than answers. So I've done a little bit of exploratory research into YouTube and how that might sort of treat particular users. It's certainly not completely, you couldn't say YouTube operates like this, because I think algorithms and users, you know, change frequently. Daily, possibly, in how they, you know, how it's programmed to recommend certain things, and then how we sort of respond to that. So it's a continual sort of process that sort of works in. But there's some really great indicators of how certain things might work. Would you like to hear some of that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So to get to that, we kind of need to understand how I conducted this research. And so I drew on a process from design thinking, or a method from design thinking, which is called persona construction.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that method, you do a lot of sort of background research into types of users in these spaces. And then you create fictional characters, and you give them, you know, personas as close as you could. So, you know, where they live, what their name might be, their age, their interests, the sorts of technology that they, you know, a number of different characteristical traits. And then you kind of cloak yourself as that person, digitally cloak yourself as that person, and then go into these platforms and, see how that particular technology treats that type of user. So, you know, you start searching for things that user is interested in.
So wait a second, you created how many?
So I created six.
You created
six as a sample.
Fictional characters.
Yeah, yeah.
That you gave some characteristic features.
Yeah.
It's like writing a novel, basically. Like you...
Kind of, yeah.
You're the author, and then you created these characters and sent them off into YouTube in that case.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. There's a couple of sort of technical steps in there as well that prevent, like, my personal, as Jonathan Hutchinson, like, mm-hmm. my personal data and whatever impacting on how these new personas would be treated. So you sort of have to start from a fresh slate as well as you can. But you're right. Yeah. So you create these personas and then you send them into these environments and just kind of observe how different platforms treat them. In my case, how YouTube treated these particular individuals.
And you wanted to see what videos were recommended to them when they searched for certain things.
Yeah, that's right.
And then you created an account for each of these people.
Correct.
A YouTube account.
Yeah.
And then you can, like, in the settings, you put different geographical locations for each one and age and
correct. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's a pretty simple kind of process. What is really important is the when you start to do the search through these platforms. So there's a really basic persona setup, which is a name, an age, a location, and maybe I'll create a Gmail address, I guess. Mm-hmm. That's sort of the main components of it. And then that you take that bare bones, you know, persona onto the platform and then start observing how different things how they're treated. And you can see it from as soon as you get onto the platform, things like gender differences,
really?
Age differences. Yeah, so
without even having searched anything.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So
Can you give us an example?
Yeah, yeah. So one of the personas was a single man, a 41-year-old man from Russia.
Mm-hmm.
And I sent that persona into YouTube, and it said it recommended things, you know, kind of like you would expect, like sports. Hunting was one of the things, MMA, so more kind of masculine type of oriented interest areas. And then I created a 62-year-old Brazilian grandmother, so, you know, kind of gender diverse as much as sort of
mm-hmm.
that can be. Different locations, different ages. And instantly the first recommendation to the female was cooking shows or lifestyle channels.
Wow.
Or so I mean it's you can just see from that very first instance that YouTube, it's trying to understand who you are, and you know, they probably have a starting point that says, oh, okay, so you're this kind of person, we know this much about you, you probably are interested in this kind of content. And then I guess wherever you click or whatever you do after that point, that's when it really, you know, it's just a framing process really.
Yeah.
to sort of put a person into a particular category.
And when you go as this fictional character onto YouTube for the first time, where does YouTube base their recommendations on? Just because they know people that have different, that have similar features, usually look at things like cooking shows or hunting videos.
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know the answer, but I assume that you're probably right. So it's probably something like based on whatever 10 plus years of however long YouTube's been going for, they understand that these kinds of users typically like these sorts of videos or this type of content.
Mm-hmm.
So that's probably where they start from. But then I guess it would be, you know, every individual case kind of makes its own way through the content. So they're probably learning as much as what they're sort of delivering content as mm-hmm. well.
And what was your next step then? Did you search for things?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So if you imagine each persona has, you know, a handful of hobbies, let's call them hobbies, and those hobbies directly related into a search term.
Mm-hmm.
So for example,
So you created those hobbies for them.
Yeah.
But you didn't
yeah.
have to put it somewhere on your Gmail account.
No. Okay, so that was more kind of like, that's it. That's the
backstage.
Word document.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Backstage. Great way to put it. Yeah. So the front stage is, you know, what's on the Google platform, YouTube, and the backstage is kind of the diagram on my office wall, which has the sort of a picture of this person and all the various attributes that's associated with them. So the hobbies would then translate or correlate into search terms. And that's a way to sort of categorize a person, but then to put them into a searchable or an individual that can be categorized in some sort of form. So that was the first process. And then from there, it starts to generate a list of recommended videos.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when the sort of social science element comes in with some data scraping and social network analysis and a few other additional processes.
Okay, let's get into that in a minute, but let's
yep.
stay with our two characters, maybe the Russian male and
yeah.
the Brazilian female.
Yeah.
Maybe we can give them names to make it more visual.
Um,
like Igor.
Perfect.
And Gabriela.
Oh, in fact, that might have been what their names were.
You think?
off my memory, but they are two fantastic
okay,
names.
Okay, Igor and Gabriela. Yep. What were they searching on YouTube for you?
So Igor was interested in things like motor racing. I tried to make them as typical as, you know, I could.
Before we go into that, yeah. What were the other three characters? So you had five in total.
There were six in total. Six. So from memory, the Brazilian grandmother, the Russian man, a transgender female from Amsterdam, mm-hmm. A 14-year-old schoolboy from Australia. There was two others.
Never mind.
Can we link to that in the description
we can,
below?
Of course. The show notes, that's what it's called in podcast.
Show notes. You're right. Show yeah. notes. Sorry, I've been hanging out on YouTube for too long. yeah, so that was the 4 to 6 characters. Uh-huh. And so we'll focus on those two. So the Russian male, I think the four interest areas were like hunting, maybe motorsport, kind of real sort of masculine types, you know, I wanted to see how they would react to something like that, as opposed to the grandmother, who I then you know, gave search terms such as you know, cooking, grandchildren, dancing.
Did you type in Portuguese or did you?
No, see, that's another interesting thing. So this was all in English as well. So you need to kind of identify the limitations of the study, and that is one of the limitations, that I'm not entirely sure you could guarantee the location of these particular users, and it's all in English at the same time. So there's a couple of limitations to the study. But as a prototype, I think it revealed some interesting observations that we could then develop on and kind of take this kind of inquiry a bit further.
And how did you make sure that YouTube registers the different locations?
So there's only one kind of step in the process, and it's difficult to be absolutely certain that this is taking the location for real, but you can give it a phone number, mm-hmm. and as you're entering the details in the first few pages, you can choose like a country code, so you know, for example, Australia +61, etc. That is because you're also doing this behind a firewall at a university which has a wide range of IP addresses. So it's kind of a little bit more difficult to pinpoint exactly where this person is coming from, let alone through a VPN. So that's kind of the only measure you've got to say where the location of the user is.
So where were we before? The Igor and Gabriela searching.
That's right. Yeah. Search terms. Mm-hmm. So quite masculine sorts of hobbies for Igor. And then things like, you know, I guess I kind of modeled her, Gabriela, on my own grandmother. So, sure. You know, things that I sort of thought maybe my grandma might be interested in. So one point here as well is that, you know, this is kind of a data ethnography. So it's always through the researcher who's the ethnographer, who's both looking, investigating and telling the story as well. So, I mean, that's another, I wouldn't call it a limitation. That's a characteristic of ethnography.
You are part of the study.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, but it's also, I think it has to be acknowledged that, you know, that this is all through my interpretation as well. And so before any of those terms are entered, you know, we had those kind of very typical types of recommendations that were coming from YouTube. So the 41-year-old man was getting things like, you know, MMA, Joe Rogan, those kinds of typical dude kind of products, whereas the female was getting things like cooking and whatnot. But interestingly, once you sort of trained the program under these personas, giving it various search terms, you could see the variation in the recommendations start to come back. And one of the most interesting observations across all of the personas was the prevalence of gaming. In regardless of who you were or where you were located or your age, gaming was the third most popular category of YouTube video that was returned to these users.
So Gabriela and Igor got the same amount of gaming videos.
Correct,
in their recommendation.
Yeah.
That's
so
really interesting.
It is, isn't it? So you can ask a lot of questions about that. And I mean, this is where probably you need to then go to YouTube and say, hey, this.
Why?
Yeah. And whether they would respond.
Assumption? Like, do you have a theory?
Well, I have a theory, but I mean, it's impossible to kind of get that checked or, you know, fact checked. But one idea that I sort of threw around with this was YouTube is the dominating platform in this space. And over here, you've got Twitch TV, which is the gaming platform, which is increasingly becoming larger and larger. The engagement rate on that platform probably dwarfs what's going on the YouTube platform. So
that's
one,
where I'm not super familiar with Twitch, but it's where a lot of people do live streaming.
Sorry, yeah, that's right. So yeah, so you might if you're into multiple MMOs, but multiple,
what is
that? So where you go online and game in like a World of Warcraft StarCraft, you know, those kinds of things. So you would be gaming, and you might have a video camera from your computer onto you. You're gaming, you're talking with your fellow gamers on this. Normally really quite experienced gamers do this kind of thing. And then there's a community channel of people chatting and saying, you know, you should go and check out what's under the rock over there, or, you know, go and do this to whatever.
Like spectators watching the game.
Esports.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you've kind of got that it's a really intense, engaged platform for both you know, producers, content producers, gamers, and the audience members. That, you know, it's a very close relationship. And I would imagine that YouTube are probably looking at that and going, wow, that's growing incredibly fast.
Okay.
So we probably need to be, you know, prevalent in that
space. Pushing the gaming content.
Yeah. And if that is true, if that is what's going on in that scenario, then that's where things like, you know, PewDiePie becomes so important for YouTube.
The biggest YouTuber, or one of the biggest YouTubers.
One of the biggest YouTubers, but also kind of rides that line of vlogger, lifestyler, influencer / gamer.
Mm-hmm.
So it might be a way for them to go, oh, you like games? We've got all these other people over here that are gamers too, but they do this other kind of content. That's untested, that theory at this point.
But it makes sense when you talk about it like this.
I think so, yeah. But I mean,
does YouTube have the same possibilities for gamer as Twitch? Can people live stream and chat and things?
I wonder. So there's a huge gaming community on YouTube, but it's more that sort of I'm playing a game and recording how I talk to the game or whatever. And I guess people then
Let's
do...
Let's plays, right? That's what they call.
Yeah, that's it, yeah. But that instant chat, you can always leave comments and things, I guess, but I think where Twitch has it over YouTube is that instant chat between the esports professional and the community of fans. It's real time. And I wonder if there's a YouTube live broadcast functionality that sort of mirrors that or mimics that, but Twitch is certainly on top of the game in that regard. Sorry, it wasn't intended at all, but they are doing quite well in comparison to YouTube in that space.
Okay, so what else did you find out about the different user experience of Igor and Gabriela?
Yeah.
Because I guess in the end, how long did you conduct this research for?
Yeah, this was over 6 months.
Six months, that's quite a long time.
Yeah.
And
so
then I guess those two people must have had a completely different experience when navigating YouTube.
Yeah. So one sort of overview of the research is to say that the whole recommender system or algorithmic calculation, or however you want to talk about that, it is really just a framing process for platforms and users. And in a commercial space, It's something that I guess is directly aligned with, you know, your commercial imperatives, like, you know, what's driving this business. Increasingly, I think that's becoming relevant for things like what's our ethical commitments to our community of users. That's becoming more and more important. Privacy issues, like all these sorts of bigger topics that are being discussed. You could sort of see that emerging in the results of how these users were being treated. Another really interesting observation of that time is how little education and science and these sorts of areas are. Okay, so there's two things to say here. Those direct genres didn't seem to appear in the top categories of videos that are being recommended. But having said that, the category of entertainment might need to be sliced and diced a few different ways.
Okay.
So education and entertainment might be quite similar. So a how-to video, a boring how-to video isn't going to attract very many likes, but something that's really entertaining, you know, how to change the tire of my car, you know, can be done in so many different ways. But if it's entertaining, it will attract more views. If it's just a straight up first, jack up the car, you know, second, you know, like no one wants to watch that at all. So that's an interesting observation in how these users are treated as well, is that the emphasis on what you might say is the emphasis on important issues or public issues or things that aren't just about selling a product seems to be slightly less in these sorts of commercial platforms.
And what do you think were the most important or the characteristics that were influencing the recommendation the most? Was it age? Was it gender? Was it location? Can you say it like
that?
Yeah,
that's
this?
A great question. I think age had a huge... Just sort of going in my head over the results that were coming out. I think age had probably one of the biggest impacts on it. It might be an easy one for a recommender to sort of go, they're in this bracket. Gender also seemed to have some sort of significance. And I think it was really obvious with male and female, but sort of the non-binary section that was anywhere within that spectrum was not so obvious.
Oh, that's interesting though. What was the transgender person that you created? What was their first YouTube screen when they logged onto YouTube?
I can't remember off the top of my head, but that would be really interesting to reflect back on. Mm-hmm. I will let you know.
I can put it in the show notes.
Let's do that. Yes. Yeah. But that's a good question. From the top of my memory, I remember this is nearly a year and a half ago this research was done. So sorry about that. I remember it being not significant that I would say, you know, it was clearly MMA, you know, like mixed martial arts versus, I don't know, a makeup tutorial or something. It wasn't obvious, but the sort of straight up masculine, straight up feminine type of characters did have a reasonably clear kind of these videos are for this sort of gender and these videos are for that type of gender.
Yeah. Mm. Let me check my notes for a second.
Mm-hmm. The random rambles in the middle.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I wanted to ask you about what about the political factors? Did you put in some political characteristics like right wing, left wing?
Yeah, I did. So some of the the transgender Amsterdam-based woman was also about things like politics and. Alt-left, I think, might have been, you know, kind of that kind of person who's interested in that sort of sector of society. And so, again, the results that came back on this person were in that same sort of category where it was the say it was the top 10, in the top 10 categories that were returned to it, science was down about 8 or 9 as kind of the only sort of area which was not toys or entertainment or beauty and lifestyle or, you know, these sorts of more entertainment skewed types of categories. Yeah, so that's an interesting kind of thing in itself, that anything which could be sort of associated with public affairs, or which you would think that kind of character would be incredibly interested in, ranked down quite low.
Let's maybe take a step back and look at your research from afar and take in the fact that YouTube is basically creating a different user experience for each of their users, like a proper bubble for them. It's like if we, as if we turn on the TV for the evening program, and we each of us sees a different sort of entertainment and news program. Maybe, what effect does this have on our society as a whole?
Yeah, this is where it gets really interesting. I think this is kind of the point of all of this. So it's in a really simplistic answer, it's a lack of diversity. So one person is exposed to a particular arena of content, which, as you say, can be different to what a second person can be exposed to. But what's interesting about a lot of them is that there's different, particularly on something like YouTube, okay, there's different forces that drive those sorts of recommendations. Now, all of this is, I would say, well, not all of it, but a majority of it is commercially oriented. So it's driven by the ads that you will see pop up on these sorts of videos. There's more consideration now than what there has been in previous years to things like privacy and security and trustworthiness and these sorts of social items that are important to us. But at the end of the day, you've still got these commercial platforms who are responsible. Like, I watch a lot of YouTube. I imagine, you know, you watch
I do, yeah.
Yeah, okay. and potentially the people listening to this podcast will also be consuming a lot of media over YouTube. So if that's one of our leading platforms, and this research is painting the picture that, you know, exposure to diversity is limited, then that's a real concern. That's a real issue. So, and I think a lot of these platforms are going through this moment where, you know, you want to keep people interested on the platform for as long as you can. That's what makes them successful. And the sort of content that's being, you know, published on these spaces, the stuff that's really engaging and entertaining, is preferenced over content that might be important yet less entertaining. So that's kind of the battlefield of this sort of this area of media and communication at the moment. So I guess that's where I see a cultural institution like public media starting to come in and play in this space more effectively. I think YouTube is fantastic, and I think it does content really, really well. I think commercial content has its place and should be there, but I also think it should be balanced out with, you know, exposure to these other sorts of areas as well. So, and that's kind of the role that I think public media can start to play in this broader ecosystem.
And how could that work out?
Yeah. Good question. So I have opinions on how that could work. Yeah. You know, that's not tested in public media as yet, but I do want to go into, and that's where I'm currently at right now, is going into public media, public service media organizations, and going, so like, how are you thinking about these sorts of things? What's your current technologies? You know, how might you sort of operate or become, stay relevant against something like YouTube, for example? So
you're doing this in Australia?
Yeah, that's when I return home. That's what I'll be doing. Plus, I want to try and talk to a couple of broadcasters here before I go. That's looking good at the moment.
Cool.
But nothing confirmed yet. So then, it's to go into the broadcasters and say, you know, this is what's happening out there, which is probably not news to them in many ways. But what should they be doing to be working and operating in this sort of space? And I think there's a couple of things that can help or contribute to exposing diversity in these spaces. So in the first instance, I think there's a call for good policy in this space. So that's not only from, you know, your sort of national kind of perspective, like a national media and communication policy kind of angle, that also trickles down into what would be considered editorial policies within each public broadcaster. So how do we embody something like diversity on these kinds of recommendation systems? You know, that's just kind of the day-to-day that content producers would then work by in public media organizations. But then I also think there's another area which is always seems to be overlooked in a lot of scholarship, and that's the agency of users of, you know, how we operate in these spaces. So there's been a lot of work, fantastic work, I would say as well, that sort of highlights how algorithms are either black boxed or, you know, we can't get into them and crack them open and whatever. But I don't know if that's kind of the way to go. And it always seems to suggest that users are kind of naive to recommendation systems and algorithms and whatnot. But I think a lot of people have a very basic, at least, understanding of how these systems work. You know, whether they looked at the mathematical equation, I don't think that would mean anything to most users. But I'm sure that they've recognized that whatever they click on or whatever they watch today has an impact on what's, you know, recommended to them tomorrow. So, I mean, there's user agency that needs to be promoted or educated in some ways. And I think that's what public media can do. So you sort of have this combination of supportive policy, which kind of pushes this diversity in recommendation to the forefront, and public media should be working with their users to try and educate them even further to not only explain that it's a potential non-diverse environment in which they find themselves, but how can they, as a particular user, you know, start to force these systems to reveal more kinds of variety in the content that they consume.
So they would, by creating their own channels and creating a following on these platforms, transform these platforms for their benefit. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. I think that's a good way. That might be a good model for how it could work.
So you're not talking about a cooperation between YouTube and the Australian public service broadcaster.
That'd be lovely. You know, from my perspective, yeah. I think that would be fantastic. That would be sort of the golden egg. But I don't think that will ever happen. And, you know, if there's any public media researchers listening to me say this at the moment, they're probably, you know, having a slight moment of, like, what is this guy saying? It's not a welcomed solution to any of this kind of material, and I can understand why. You know, it's they're different sorts of organizations that may never play well in the sandpit together. But having said that, I think the role of the public broadcaster in this kind of instance is, YouTube is very successful and has an amazingly high audience number. There's no point in trying to replicate, you know, the public tube or I don't know, you know, like no one will go there. Yeah, you just won't go to that platform. And I feel warm and fuzzy because I'm not on YouTube at the moment. So you know, it has to remain on YouTube, this sort of content. But the public media organization could become something like a micro platform and situate themselves, bring their audience to YouTube and kind of go, this content here is really, really important. And, you know, that content there is fun and, you know, go and watch that, whatever it might be.
Gamer.
Yep. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, go and watch that. That's really interesting. But you also need to be aware of this. Like, this is really important at the moment. This is what's happening in sports and culture, or this is what's happening in politics, or I don't know, the latest issues on food security or something. You need to be aware of these.
Do you think the news broadcasters need to then create YouTube specific content that's a little bit more, I don't know, how to understand the Australian elections?
Or yeah.
Like very simple clickbaiting.
Probably.
Type of content.
Yeah. So there's an interesting case study from South Korea. So the Korean Herald, I think it is, from memory. So their situation is not too dissimilar from this. They've got news portals, and all the South Korean citizens go to these news portals over like the native news website or Google as well. They, you know, these two portals sort of predominantly Naver. Naver is like their Google in many ways. Mm-hmm. So they, a lot of the people go to these particular spaces, and it preferences the sorts of news that's given to them. And one of those news agencies is the Korean Herald. I'm pretty sure it's the Korean Herald. Their strategy at the moment for news production, they can see this whole explosion of entertainment is, you know, news and information is, it's important, but everyone wants to see what's happening with, you know, the boy bands, the Korean
K-pop.
K-pop. That's it. Everyone wants to know what's happening with K-pop. That's the hot ticket right there. So they've created a department within their news agency which specifically creates content for YouTube that looks at K-pop. And so that's a way to engage a particular demographic of their audience. And they're like, oh, so now I'm up to date with what's happening in the K-pop. Did you know that trade affairs have also gone sour with China or whatever it might be? You know, it's not so black and white as that, but it's this kind of, you know, get the audience accustomed to the Korean Herald, and then they know that the Korean Herald also, you know, work in these other important areas as well. So it could be that kind of model, as you suggest, that's... I don't want to say clickbait.
No, yeah, that was a bit exaggerated.
But
yeah.
It is that kind of approach, yeah.
Okay. I wanted to talk to you a little bit about your role as a researcher or your methods as a researcher, because I feel like increasingly media researchers have to be programmers and really fit in everything that's dealing with digital data and computational science or whatnot. Would you agree?
Yeah, absolutely.
And in your research, did you program a lot? Because you did not by yourself create these characters and then as Gabriella go around YouTube and click on every video by yourself. That was a automated you created a program that did that for you, no?
So it was a combination of so I'm a trained ethnographer, so I come from humanities, and my primary weapon is qualitative research. Okay, so you know, ethnography, interviews, field data, you know, these sorts of techniques are what I, as a humanities scholar, feel very comfortable with. But having said that, a lot of our research now takes place on digital platforms. And so a large proportion of media scholars have actually one of your newly minted doctors here, Dr. Felix Munch, has said it very well, where he had this diagram which showed how the two are kind of met. You've got hard social science over here, and then you've got humanities scholars here, and they're slowly sort of kind of coming together, and there's this bubble in the middle. And I think a lot of us are starting to, you know, you don't ever go all the way over to social science, and social scientists don't ever always come over to humanities, but we kind of meet somewhere in the middle. And I guess that depends on how skilled you are in each disciplinary area. So I've had to learn, you know, I can't code, I can't develop, but I have enough DIY now to sort of make things happen. And I always get to that
watch
point.
YouTube tutorials exactly. about programming.
Yeah, that's right. And I always find myself, I get to a point where I can't go any further, and that's where you need to bring in the social scientist or the, you know, the data scientist, and can you make this code thing work here for me? But then they bring in their own disciplinary perspective as well, and you know, kind of, why are you doing it this way? Why wouldn't you? Can I show you a much more efficient way of doing something? And it's like, oh wow, look at the results! Like, wow, you know, you found this out, and so it's this really nice kind of collaborative experience. Mm-hmm. But from an individual perspective, yes, you do need to have these sorts of social science skills, and they do enable you to do new kinds of research for sure.
And as if somebody wants to start out and say, okay, I'm going to study media science, what would you recommend to them nowadays? Should they also try to learn as much programming as possible?
Yeah, I mean, I think most, certainly a lot of journalist schools, you know, this is something that they ensure undergraduates go through now, is it's not just how to tell a story and be an investigative journalist, but, you know, basic programming skills. I think in media studies, that's still not the norm, broadly speaking, to incorporate any kind of programming or developing in there, unless students kind of take electives or whatever. But certainly, as someone who's coming through in a postgraduate kind of capacity, working on track to doing a PhD, certainly in media studies, having a basic knowledge of things like R or Python.
Those are programming languages.
That's right. Yes. Sorry. Yes. Yes. Thank you for clarifying. Yeah, those kinds of programming languages is really super important.
Mm-hmm. But you know, like for this research that we just talked about, you did not use any of these.
So I relied on, so at the University of Amsterdam, there's the Digital Methods Initiative, which is a fantastic resource for all sorts of research all over the world. And I think it's Bernard Reiner is the person who created all the YouTube tools. And don't quote me on that, but I think he's the person that did that. Whoever it was has created these fantastic, a fantastic suite of tools that enable people to look at what's called the API, the application program interface of the YouTube platform, which is kind of like a backdoor into, you know, their database, particular areas of their database. And so I kind of approached this as a qualitative researcher and went, oh, there's something happening here. Like, what is it? I'm not exactly clear. And then you can go to the YouTube tools and then start actually coming in from the side and kind of scraping data using a various, you know, kind of social network analysis tools or topic modeling or a number of these sorts of computational methods, which then kind of bring back a series of results. And then you kind of look at the results and go, that's interesting.
Like, but what did the results look like? You had like the titles of the videos that were recommended or?
All like sorts. Yeah, all sorts from video channel networks. So you might identify a particular video channel and go, they're doing important stuff or interesting work here. How are they connected? Like, what does their network of other video channels look like? Through to video networks themselves. So this particular video is significantly important because of XYZ, whatever reason. And then you can start to map how it actually is located within a broader video network of, you know, videos on YouTube. Then down to things like comment threads, you know, you could export that, scrape that and export it, and then try to look at, well, what are the people talking about? If this is an important video, what are people talking about in this particular thread? You know, a variety of things.
But the data that you used,
yep.
What did it look like?
So it looked like a combination of Excel sheets, Gephi files, and Gephi is a social network analysis program. Excel, Gephi, that was kind of it. They're the big ones that I use. And so you bring those in to whatever program you're using and then process it. Clean the data, process the data, and sort of then reiterate on what the research questions are.
Cool. Mm. I want to slowly come to an end of this conversation, but I have a last topic that I wanted to address, because you said earlier that YouTube is kind of this black box where nobody really knows which algorithms play what role. And do you think that, like, your research observed the recommendation system of YouTube and try to find out how it treats people differently according to different features? Mm-hmm. And do you think that if you went to the YouTube headquarters and asked these questions, would a programmer be able to answer them for you so that you wouldn't have to do all this research?
Possibly. It's a really good question. And there's a couple of things that I think you need to think through here too. So the first one is access, right? So, you know, knowing the right person to get access to these sorts of platforms is key. And often when you try and approach these kinds of commercial platforms, you're kind of given the PR person. I just say this because this recently happened in South Korea when we went to talk to people about, uh-huh. you know, what's happening with these news portals. And, you know, they sort of wheel out the, kind of make it sound really bad, but they present us with the public relations person who then, you know, proceeds to inform you about the ethos of the business, which is great. I mean, you find out a lot from that. But what would be really useful is to get to the developers, right, who create these sorts of platforms and you know, make these decisions on how certain things operate. And when you get to that point, if you do, sort of sounds like a game, like, you know, you've passed level one, you're in level two now, you know, talking to the developer, I think there's intellectual property issues at play here. So possibly, okay, so somewhere like ZDF, for example, they're working on algorithms and recommender systems there at the moment. They're reasonably okay to share. It's all open source coding, so they're not sort of closing it down and saying, you know, no one can see what we're doing here. But I think in the context of YouTube, I don't imagine they would be that open to saying, sure, we recommend these sorts of videos because we make more money out of it, or, you know, whatever the reason might be. I don't think they would be that open to saying that kind of comment. But if they were, you're right, it would make a whole lot of this research kind of redundant.
But is that a desirable scenario, that YouTube sort of opens its doors and shows everyone how the algorithms work? And
I think we want that to happen, but I don't know what advantage at the end of the day. I think we kind of understand why things work the way they work, and it's kind of like walking into, I don't know, maybe one of the, just here's a Hamburg example, walking into one of the big, you know, shipping companies here and saying, right, how does your profit model work, you know, like, could you tell me how do you make money here? And they would, you know, if you had the right, if you're the right person, they'd probably go, yes, this is what it looks like. But, you know, to you and I, we'd sort of look at it and go, okay, there's lots of numbers there. That's fantastic. So I don't know if having an open YouTube is necessarily the best answer, but I mean, it's a nice concept to think of.
Yeah, I'm just thinking, because YouTube's role in the individual formation of opinion, for instance, is much higher than the one of a shipping company, I guess. And YouTube, in a democratic sense, is very powerful.
Yeah.
Because people like get their information from there and they base their opinions on political decisions, maybe on what they find on YouTube. So.
Yeah. So maybe it's not an individual kind of access. Maybe that's more of a policy discussion, right? So, the same as an individual country might make a specific kind of media agenda. You can have a commercial license, you must have a public service media license or whatever it might be, these sorts of rules and regulations. They don't apply to these things like YouTube or whatever at the moment because they're not media companies, right? They're tech.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. So here's a inherent problem with this kind of approach is that, policy levers would be the solution to a lot of this, where a government could say, YouTube, we love you. Like, you do a great job. We absolutely love what you do. Thanks for being in our country. But we need you to kind of just alter the recommendations a little bit to bring in a little bit of public affairs content into diversity calculations for your users. That's probably the best kind of arrangement that you could have, with just that soft government touch of continue what you do, but for everyone to be happy here, you need to do a little bit more of this. But they do such a great job of avoiding that by saying, oh no.
So you don't see this happening, because I know that Facebook is doing sort of like trying to, for instance, work against fake news and try to push quality content more than sort of dubious content.
Yeah.
But YouTube did not show any signs of...
To take the devil's advocate position on Facebook, I think that's a bit of a PR movement. The only thing that can make Facebook move, we've seen that, policy can't impact them in much of a way. The only thing that can impact them is, consumer dollars, right? So if there aren't eyeballs on the platform, then they have to make changes to get those eyeballs back, and that's what we're seeing now. And the hot topic is privacy, yeah? So that's where they're trying to kind of backpedal, I think, in that sort of space. In YouTube, I don't think they're still in the golden hour or something at the moment. So I think their viewership is still really quite high. They can still keep growing their market. They're sort of... they're protected in many ways from something like a policy lever from that regard.
Thank you, Jonathan, for sharing your insight, the insight into your research with us. Mm. That was very interesting. Is there anything left to say, you think?
There will be some publications coming out about this. Mm-hmm. So stay tuned.
Stay tuned, guess. Yeah.
Yeah. maybe kind of the one point to kind of make about this is that I think it's a really important area that more people should be researching into. And maybe just to highlight the fact that these sorts of environments change all the time. So I think it's a particular onus on us as researchers to be able to change as these kinds of environments change as well.
You're leaving us in a couple of weeks, right?
I am, yeah.
That's very sad. You've been here for?
A good part of 6 months, so coming up to 5 months now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was great having you here.
It was great to be here. It's been fantastic.
Thank you. And, we say goodbye to our listeners. Subscribe to our podcast on Spotify and iTunes and whatnot. We say, what's the Australian way to say goodbye?
See ya, mate. Have a good one.
Okay, on that note, goodbye.
Bredocast. Wir erforschen was mit Medien.